With a new e-reading device now arriving on the market, every book you read could have its own network. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will all be talking about when they return to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show, as always, is Andrew Albanese, PW's features editor. Andrew, welcome back.
Greetings, Chris.
Well, it's good to have you join us again. I'm beginning to really like these programs because I feel like I'm on top of the news when we chat with you, Andrew. And you had a special visitor this week in the offices.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, on Wednesday, Kobo's Matt Welch and Jason Gamblin stopped by the PW offices to show off their new tablet, the Kobo Vox. As we discussed last week, the Vox is a 7-inch Android 2.3 tablet that can run standard Android apps as well as 15,000, I believe, free Android apps that are all optimized for the device. Our resident tablet monster, Calvin Reed, liked it a lot. And of course, as we also discussed last week, it's an open platform. So to be clear, that means that you can actually bring in ebooks and other e-reading apps from other retailers and use them on your Kobo Vox. Now, you still have to deal with the Adobe DRM, so it's not all peace, love, and understanding. But, you know, as Welch says, it's pretty easy to navigate, and we'll soon see if it's easy enough to win consumers because the device starts shipping today. In addition, as you mentioned, Kobo's Reading Life social reading software is pretty fun, and it allows you to have a networked book experience through a platform called Pulse. It lets you start a conversation on any page of any Kobo ebook. And, you know, I have to say that's one way that Kobo can influence readers to choose their reading experience over Kindle, for example, you know, by adding value. It's a platform that doesn't lock you in, and it gives you these fun little add-ons. Now, Kindle obviously is a huge head start over Kobo. And I don't even say it's a huge head start, but they have a head start in the market. It was the first to really crack the e-reader nut, at least. And now there's Apple and Google and Barnes & Noble, and you have these other major players that are getting in the game. But, you know, I can't say it enough. This competition is good. The competition is on. And it's worth noting that Kobo is pretty well positioned to compete with Amazon internationally. So let's see if they can compete with Amazon here at home.
Well, you know, all good points, Andrew. And we should make note of the fact that Kobo is, of course, a Canadian-based outfit. And today we read in CBC reporting, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation reporting, that they are going to start entering another area that Amazon has had pretty much to themselves so far, and that is the self-publishing area.
Yeah, you know, and again, I think that all goes back to competition, which, you know, again, I'm a broken record, but I think it's a good thing. We've heard a lot of talk recently about Amazon and now Kobo becoming publishers, and we've also heard talk about agents becoming publishers. And I think the question is, why are they doing this? And the answer is because there's an opportunity. You know, publishers are clearly not fulfilling the needs and desires of at least some part of the market, right? And I think mid-list authors and niche authors are finding the major publishing houses are not an option, and authors, you know, by and large are not happy with e-royalty rates, for example. So you're going to have new ventures like this. Now, there are conflicts and there are issues, of course. You know, for example, how do you audit your ebook sales if your publisher is also your retailer? But the reality is, if publishers don't want or don't win these certain authors, there's going to be these new options. And as imperfect as they may be, this is the trend. There's going to be more competition, not less. And, you know, big publishing may be very wary of the competition it's going to receive from Amazon or perhaps Kobo's publishing efforts. But I think, you know, the fact is big publishing helped to create this opportunity for Amazon and the other upstarts.
I think that's a worthwhile point. You mentioned publishers that don't want authors. I hate to tell you, there are some authors out there that don't want anything to do with publishers either.
That's true.
So it works both ways. Well, also in the news this week is something that concerns us here. Of course, copyright is our first name at Copyright Clearance Center. And the new Register of Copyrights, Maria Pawlenty, has released a paper that outlines her agenda for the next couple of years.
That's right. Now in her first full year of Register of Copyrights, Pawlenty delivered a pretty loud and clear message on copyright. And that message is that, you know, government is paying attention. Her paper articulated 17 priorities in copyright policy and administrative practice, and also another 10 quote-unquote new projects that are designed to improve the quality and efficiency of the U.S. Copyright Office over the next 2 years. Among those priorities are orphan works and preservation for libraries, mass book digitization, and of course, fighting digital piracy. But in addition to these broad, somewhat thorny issues, many of which are going to require acts of Congress to address, Pallante also noted that the administrative practices of the office will also be examined during the next 2 years, including a review of regulatory issues and things like the copyrightability and the registration of websites, and a look at other forms of digital authorship. So my first read on this is that it's great. It's really great news, and clearly Pallante has been paying very close attention to the issues that we've all been living through in the publishing world. And I think she's going to be a valuable resource, and her term as registrar is off to a good start. But the real question going forward is, what can, what will government do? And I think more to the point, who is Congress going to pay attention to on these subjects? Now, I'm not being cynical here, but Congress does tend to hear the voices of the people around them. And the people around Congress tend to be industry lobbyists. And there's also a movement to harmonize copyright globally via things like trade agreements. You know, but it's worth noting that copyright in the U.S. is fundamentally different than it is from Europe or in other places. You know, we have a mission to promote progress, cultural progress here, to encourage the creation of more culture, not just profits. So, you know, it's a self-professed copyright geek, as you well know. I love this stuff, but I would say to the wider world that it's really time to pay attention. I don't expect there's going to be much congressional action in the next 2 years, and not because Congress is dysfunctional, but simply because the market is still developing. But the public needs to be involved, and if we all have a substantial interest in a vibrant copyright system, I'm afraid if we don't all get involved now, the public's interest could be overlooked here.
Well, you know, that's true, and not so new, really. You know, people have been concerned about copyright going back for some time. Mark Twain, who not only was an author but a publisher, was very active in a drive to reform copyright law, but he became disappointed by it. He said, you know, whenever it comes time to reform the copyright laws, that's when the idiots assemble. So I suppose it's a question of be careful what you wish for. He might have thought it was better if they'd just left it all alone. What else do we have coming out in PW this week?
Well, it's not all about digital, though it all seems to be touching on digital. But Monday's issue also has a really interesting feature on how printers and manufacturers are adjusting. People love to talk about how digital is going to displace print, but in fact, digital also is helping printers with more efficient equipment and the ability to do shorter print runs, for example, and more quickly. And that's helping publishers keep their inventories lean and is counteracting the loss of scale they had before ebooks began cutting into their print runs. And you won't want to miss our soapbox from Larry Hughes, who is very funny, and he takes on the asterisk, a subject that's long overdue. And also, there's a two-page article on what Library Journal has just released, volume one of a fascinating quarterly study of the library market. It's called Patron Profiles. And really, it couldn't come at a better time. With the ebook wars and a bunch of recent lawsuits, it seems to me that the work of libraries has never been more misunderstood and pretty much never been more important. So the data that this first Patron Profile shows, it pretty much shows that libraries are actually driving revenue for publishers. It debunks some of the popular myths that a borrowed ebook or a borrowed book is a lost sale. In fact, more than half of the users surveyed for the Patron Profiles, and this was just this past August, say they've bought books from authors they discovered at their library. So not only are libraries a major channel in and of themselves, spending billions on publisher products every year, their patrons go out and buy books too. So library patrons are pretty much publishers' best customers. So we have a two-page preview of the LJA Patron Profiles with a few notable charts and graphs in the study, and it's very interesting reading.
Well, we'll look for that. It's always good to kind of dispel some myths and misconceptions. Andrew Albanese, PW's features editor, thanks so much. And I want to turn now to Rose Fox, a PW Reviews editor who blogs on the site at Genreville. Rose, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Thank you, Chris. It's always good to be here.
Well, we enjoy it, and as I say, it keeps me up on things. I can't read all the books you talk about, but I wish I could. And what are we going to be reading or listening to coming up next week?
Well, this week we do indeed have an audiobook section. In fiction, we single out John Keating's entertaining recording of Owen Colfer's Plugged, which is his first book for adults. There's a full cast production of Anton Chekhov's Three Sisters, and Edward Wallace's classic crime novel, The Council of Justice, for which Bill Homewood provides rich, eloquent narration. There are also some top-notch nonfiction audiobooks, including Jane Lynch's memoir, Happy Accidents, and Penn Jillette's God No, Signs You May Already Be an Atheist, each read by its author.
Yeah. Well, you know, what we're always amazed by, Rose, is how well you manage to get through all the various names from around the world that you have to pronounce. And again, the reviews section is all over the map. Tell us what we can see there.
Well, if you remember a couple of weeks ago, I had some real tongue twisters because the reviews section had a particularly international flavor, and we reprise that this week with Q&As discussing a couple of the books that we mentioned then. So in nonfiction, we interview Sonia Falero, author of Beautiful Thing, an expose about bar dancers in Mumbai, and there's also a mystery Q&A with Colin Cotterill, author of Slash and Burn, the eighth and final of his Laotian mysteries. And we have a great big double Q&A. This one is terrific. With Eduardo Jimenez Mayo and Chris N. Brown, respectively, the translator and editor of Three Messages and a Warning, a collection of fantastical stories by new and established Mexican writers. The global travel doesn't stop there. Our fiction reviews include Hope, a Tragedy by Shalom Auslander, a debut novel with a strong Jewish voice that our reviewer says mixes self-deprecation, mordant compliance, hypochondria, and a total lack of surprise when disaster occurs. In Mysteries and Thrillers, we review Martin Limon's Mr. Kill, an investigation set in South Korea in 1974. The SF fantasy horror section highlights Hell Train by Christopher Fowler, in which an American travels to London to write the script for the latest Hammer Films horror movie. In romance, we review Katie McAllister's It's All Greek to Me, a charming contemporary romance set on a Greek island. And in comics, we cover Michael Choquette's anthology of The Someday Funnies, a priceless time capsule of comics history that surveys and lampoons the European music scene of the 1960s.
You've got something to tell us about for nonfiction as well. A reviewer says this is a really timely book about an issue that matters to all of us.
That's right. We have a big review of Paper Promises by Philip Kogan, which explains the current financial crisis in a way that's very accessible to lay people. We also have Agatha Christie, Murder in the Making, which is John Curran's impressive second book of meticulously deciphered and organized notes from Christie's notebooks. And finally, in children's books, we cover two adorable picture books about porcupines, Hugs from Pearl, written and illustrated by Paul Schmid, and Mr. Prickles, a quill-faded love story written by Cara LaRoe and illustrated by Scott Magoon. We also have five picture book reviews about big ideas like shapes, time, and language. And our middle grade and young adult fiction section includes Michaela McCull's Promise the Night, which our reviewer says is a rousing piece of historical fiction, and Jennifer Lynn Barnes's Every Other Day, an urban fantasy novel that will appeal as much to adults as to teens. Elsewhere in the magazine, we have a profile of Christopher Gofford, author of You Will See Fire, which talks about a possibly politically motivated death in Kenya.
Well, Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor who blogs at Genreville, thanks for that rundown of the books reviewed in Publishers Weekly this coming issue.
You're welcome, Chris. I do want to take another moment, incidentally, to put in a plug for some reviews that are going up on our news blog, PWXYZ. As you may be aware, in a couple of weeks, we have our Best Books of the Year issue coming out. And as we did last year, every day, one of the editors in the reviews section is putting up a post about one of the books that's going to be on our top 100 list. So mine has just gone up for one of our science fiction titles. It's just a tremendous selection this year, and if anyone has some spare reading time, as I unfortunately do not, and they want something to look at to get an idea of what books they should be picking up that were top-notch in 2011, this is a great place to start.
Well, we'll make sure to link to that on our own site at beyondthebook.com. I also want to thank Andrew Albanese as well for giving us the news rundown earlier. Andrew, good to have you back.
Good to be here. My pleasure as always.
Well, we enjoy having this special Friday feature in our podcast series at CCC. We call it The Week Ahead with PW. Publishers Weekly is the leading publication serving all involved in the creation, production, marketing, and sale of the written word in all its formats. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.